If you, like me, are craving seafood for dinner and want a piece of fish from your local waters, well, good luck.
We have built a system designed to take product away from local communities as quickly as possible and get it in the global market. And if you build a highway around the globe that has no off-ramps to local communities, it's no wonder people can't get access to local product.
You're listening to Gravy.
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 A production of the Southern Foodways Alliance, Gravy tells the stories of the changing American South. I'm your host, Melissa Hall. So, my dad was an accomplished and obsessive fisherman. So was my grandfather, and most of their friends were too. And as a result, I grew up eating a lot of fish. And I grew up knowing, often to the name of the inlet where that fish was caught, and pretty much to the minute when it came out of the water. Now that I rely on the grocery store for fish, the question of provenance is much more complicated. In my last visit to the Kroger fish counter, I found both farmed salmon and Alaskan wild salmon. There were some Argentinian shrimp nestled near the Chilean sea bass, all of it previously frozen, and none of it carrying a provenance more precise than whatever was stamped on the box it was shipped in. It turns out, even if I did live close to the ocean, I wouldn't necessarily be eating local fish. Our reporter, Irina Zhuroff, lives on the Gulf Coast. She wanted to find local seafood and couldn't. When she finally found one shop with fresh fish from the Gulf, she started to wonder, why aren't there more? Irina Zhuroff has the story. But first,
for cultivating progress across the South, for working to unconditionally improve the lives of all, and for the bold underwriting of every Gravy podcast, SFA thanks our visionary Louisville, Kentucky friends, Pam and Brooke Smith.
David Ramey is a chef at Red or White in Fairhope, Alabama. Fairhope is a wealthy town across the bay from Mobile. It was founded on utopian principles and retains a kind of idyllic feel to it. The restaurant is small, just off the main street, and when I dropped in on a spring weekday, I found David planting herbs out back. Inside, it was cool and dark.
We focus on Southern Italian. We do a lot of pizzas. We also focus on artisan cheese and charcuterie. We always have great bread.
He's big on technique and even bigger on letting local seasonal ingredients shine. He rattles off a bunch of farmers they work with by name.
Urban Pepper Farm from Mobile, Cottrell's Honey down on County Road 1 here in Fairhope.
But one thing he had trouble sourcing when he started the job was seafood, which is odd because Fairhope is on the water with easy access to the Gulf of Mexico through Mobile Bay.
It's difficult here. I mean, it's not a food desert, but there's not a lot of people that focus on high-end ingredients that realize sustainability and try to focus on the quality ingredients.
The Gulf is rich with fish, and locals as well as tourists like to eat it. So why would it be so hard to find local seafood here? No one I spoke with could give a definitive answer. Theories included a complex and costly regulatory system that bars entry for many fishers, and imports that are pricing many fishing families out of the business. Paul Greenberg, a journalist who reports on seafood and has written several books about it, including Four Fish and American Catch, The Fight for a Local Seafood, thinks perhaps an informality and ubiquity of fishing friends might have something to do with it too.
The Gulf is funny because a lot of times, my experience of the Gulf is most people who are into fish know somebody who fishes. And oftentimes, like, hey, I just got back from a grouper trip. You want a grouper? And you get a grouper. Yeah, and you're like, oh, cool. And it didn't cost anything.
Or maybe it's how restaurants and people prefer to cook their seafood here. Fried, often.
I mean, I remember once somebody in the Gulf said in Louisiana said to me that for most people in Louisiana, seafood was a dough delivery system.
Which can destroy the subtle taste of quality in a fresh fish and hide the imperfections of an imported product. Whatever the reasons, it takes some serious effort to find fresh fish here. Chef David was making do with fish from larger distributors when one day, scrolling on Instagram, he came across Fairhope Fish House, a little seafood shop run by Jake Pose and Dustin Bedgood. They do day boat fishing, which means they go out for about 24 hours and then return with whatever they catch. Their fish is ready to sell within hours of harvest. They send an email to their followers listing what they'll have and the shop hours. Otherwise, the shop is closed. Dustin does a lot of the fishing. He says it's just something he's always done.
I love to be outside, especially on the water. And once I started going offshore, it was kind of hard to do anything else.
For years, he'd been running charter boats or captaining private vessels and fishing on days off. Then he met Jake on the water.
We would just end up at the same spots fishing, you know, 80, 100 miles offshore. I would see him, and I seen him out there by himself a couple of times, you know, and that's, you don't see many people do that.
They entered a fishing tournament together.
We had caught some really big fish, a couple of big swords and a big tuna, and we took them to a fish house and sold them, and they just gave us like pennies for them.
Fish houses process and distribute fish, kind of like wholesalers, and oftentimes they're sending their product elsewhere. Atlanta, Birmingham, or even New York City.
And we just decided then that we kind of wanted to start something to be able to sell our catch and to try to get other fishermen to fish and sell their catch also. Because most of all the fish you find in restaurants and a lot of other fish markets and stuff, there it's just imported fish, and we wanted to do something that, you know, different.
Before around the, I'd say, early 20th century, most Americans, if they were going to eat seafood, were going to eat from their home coast.
This is Paul Greenberg again, the journalist. He says in the early to mid-20th century, ice and freezing technologies became more accessible, so fish could travel farther.
But there wasn't the kind of crazy international trade in seafood that there is now. Today, even though the United States controls more ocean than any country on Earth, somewhere between 80 and 90% of our seafood is imported.
At the same time, much of what is caught here ends up abroad. As seafood has become more mobile, its provenance has become more opaque. Seafood coming in, seafood going out, and very little traceability or information about what's what.
There's not really any kind of brand in seafood that allows us to connote quality.
There are some labels that help consumers make choices, like OceanWise, which purports to indicate sustainable practices by the harvesters. Or there's Marine Stewardship Council and Aquaculture Stewardship Council labels, which are supposed to imply certain safe fishing and production practices. But they don't give specifics. They don't help the consumer identify local sources of seafood, or tell you when and where something was caught. And Dustin? He wanted more.
We wanted to be able to have a local product.
And to sell that product, they also needed to be able to distinguish it from what was already available.
The way our fish is different, it's just the amount of time we're out fishing, we keep it to, you know, way shorter trips than most commercial operations.
Large ships can spend weeks or even months at sea. Those industrial fishers often freeze their fish, which can then travel between states or even countries to get processed before ending up on a local shelf. Also, Fairhope Fish House catch their fish one at a time.
Mostly rod and reel.
So they don't really have bycatch. Those are animals trapped in nets that aren't being targeted or can't be sold, which often perish once released.
Once we catch that fish, we properly dispose of it.
Even if fish are biting, they stop fishing.
It's hard to slow down, take care of the fish, but you know, we put a focus on that, of taking care of the fish, because we care about what they look like.
They get the fish on deck and lay it out on a beanbag or soft pad so it doesn't bruise itself thrashing about. And they perform something called ikijime, a Japanese method to quickly kill and bleed the fish.
So you expose the spinal column, and on the bigger fish, find that, and you take a wire rod or a monofilament or something, and you run down the spinal cord, killing all the nerves. Or you can actually take a brain spike or something and spike that spinal cord.
That kills the fish instantly. Then they lay them in seawater and let them bleed out completely before icing them down.
the fish is a lot cleaner when you handle it the way we do. Like, I could take a fillet from a fish that we've handled and a fillet from somebody else's handled and lay them side by side and easily pick out the one, our fish. When you clean it, there's going to be zero blood in it. And there's going to be no blood on the fillet. It's going to be all nice and clean.
Scientists have found evidence at the cellular level that processing a catch in this way can extend its freshness and preserve a better taste. Chef David confirms this. He says when he purchases fish treated this way, it stays fresh longer. An anthropologist who studies French fishermen, who also use ikejime, told me it makes for a valuable narrative, too. Employing ikejime, which takes time and skill, makes the fishers out to be artisans rather than industrial producers. Fairhope Fish House does all of these things. The short time from catching to selling, the way they catch using reel and rod, and their processing, because it results in the kind of fish they want to eat. But it's also a clear story of provenance that's hard to find at a supermarket or even at other seafood shops. Back at Red or White Restaurant in Fairhope, Chef David Ramey brings me a plate with a hunk of raw fish on it. He'd picked it up the previous day from Dustin.
Today we got some swordfish. They caught it on Sunday.
Fairhope Fish House tries to keep prices competitive with the cheap imports, but David says he pays about $4 more per pound for the product over a traditional distributor. For him, it's worth it. The fish in front of me is white, kind of opalescent. I don't know a ton about fish, but I can tell it looks much different than grocery store fish.
You can see this has a nice pink hue to it. It's really glistening, and there's no really, it's dry almost. You can see that it's dry. There's no moisture coming off of it or wicking away, and it looks firm.
David says many of his diners tell him they don't like swordfish because it tends to have an ammonia taste to it.
And then when they come in here and they have the fresh swordfish, sometimes we have to talk to them to it, you know, and we get it. And when they have it, they're like, I've never had swordfish like that before. Because it's clean, it's fresh, and it's sweet. And the meatiness is, swordfish is already a meaty fish, but when it's fresh like this, it's like a pork chop almost.
David also tells them about the Fairhope Fish House guys, building a connection between diners' taste buds and their sense of place to the nearby water and the people who work it. He whisked the plate away to the small kitchen to prepare it.
We'll take a quick break while the fish cooks, and when we come back, we'll learn that even though Fairhope Fish House may feel like they're all alone in their quest to provide local fresh fish, they're not. Sort of. But first...
Maker's Mark Bourbon is aged to taste in Loretto, Kentucky. The Samuels family uses locally grown, soft red winter wheat and sources water from a lake on the distillery's campus. Every Maker's Mark label is printed and die-cut by hand on an antique press, and each bottle is hand-dipped in their signature red wax. All the details matter when distilling quality bourbon. Since Maker's Mark sold its first case of bourbon to the Keeneland Racecourse in Lexington, they have perfected the craft of distilling American whiskey. For their dedication to making great bourbon and for their support of the Southern Foodways Alliance, we thank them. Maker's Mark crafts their bourbon carefully. Please enjoy it that way.
When Joshua Stoll was a graduate student, he was living near the North Carolina coast, down east as many locals call it, in an area full of historic fishing communities. He's from Maine and has always been interested in seafood. He was studying seafood, and he started asking local fishermen where their catch went.
One of the things that really jumped out to me personally was everyone knew, obviously, where they were catching the fish they were catching, and they knew who they were selling to. But after that point, it sort of became this mythical story.
There were tales of processing facilities and auctions and rumors that their catch ended up in New York City. This was around 2009. He says many of the fishermen were struggling to make ends meet through the industrial, high-volume fishing they'd been doing and were casting about for something different. Joshua and some other graduate students worked with the fishermen to start a community-supported fishery, a direct-to-consumer model like the farm CSAs that were catching on in many communities at that time. You pay a subscription fee per week or month, and you receive a set amount of fish. They set up a P.O. box at the post office and started advertising shares of seafood. A couple of checks arrived in the mail.
And we thought, oh my God, this is amazing. And, you know, all celebratory. And then a couple more checks came and, you know, it was like, wow, this is working. And then I remember somebody went to the post office and there was a little note in the mailbox from the post office. And they're like, come see us. And it was because we got so many checks, they couldn't all fit in the mailbox.
He says the demand was insatiable. Eventually, they had to start sending checks back to people because there weren't enough shares to go around.
People were hungry for business models that felt like they were making direct investments in their community.
Many fishing families are leaving the industry because it's no longer economical to be involved in the fishery. Either due to licenses becoming increasingly expensive or just not finding a good market for their catch. I'm Sahir Advani. I'm a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Maine.
He studies small-scale fisheries, and he says by continuing to fish locally, to sell locally, and to buy locally, the participants of these systems make up a kind of resistance to the larger industrial forces that shape their foodways, their communities, and ultimately, their lives. In other words, everyone who buys in is investing in more than protein. They're investing in their neighbors and the feeling they get when they see the boat's silhouettes on the water.
It's recognizing that this is a livelihood that matters a lot to seafood harvesters and fishing communities. And it's something that needs to be preserved by really valuing the catch and the work that goes behind it. Valuing that connection with coastal spaces that helps seafood harvesters make a livelihood for themselves, but also strengthens that connection between just a diner or a consumer with the seafood on their plate, who doesn't just see it as just a piece of meat or protein, but sees it as something that having a way more nuanced story behind how it's caught, how it's prepared, and how it's sold.
Joshua Stoll took his experiences in North Carolina when he returned home to Maine as faculty in the School of Marine Sciences at the University of Maine. And he started an organization called the Local Catch Network. It's a network of fishers and their supporters from around the country who sell their harvests locally, often directly to consumers or through small distributors. They share technical expertise, marketing ideas, woes, everything. Research by the network estimates that 12% of fishers, even larger outfits, practice some kind of direct-to-consumer marketing. That's more than in the ag sector. So Fairhoop Fish House isn't alone.
I think for a lot of the communities that I've had the chance to work with, like part of the value that they bring is a transparent, authentic story that sometimes has lots of gloss and fancy words and catchphrases.
Like Fairhope Fish House's language, dayboat, rod and reel caught, ikajime.
And in some cases, it's not, right? It's the like right off the boat, person doesn't really have very much time to talk to you and is a little bit grumpy about it. But I think in both cases, when it is authentic and that connection is real between the person buying the product and where it is coming from, I think that creates a tremendous amount of value, both from an economic standpoint, but also as one fisherman I know has shared with me, it sort of like nourishes the soul.
In the U.S., we don't eat a ton of fish compared to land animals. On the whole, we're not particularly sophisticated about species or quality. Seafood tends to be expensive, and many people don't know how to cook it. Most of the seafood we consume, we buy in restaurants. Some consumers generally want to know more about their food and where it comes from. Dustin Bedgood, co-owner of the Fairhope Fish House, says he has a few customers like that who call him asking about their practices and where and when they're catching fish. And the rest?
I don't know. Maybe new customers, I think they're intrigued by the fact that we actually catch the fish. They see the boat out there. They see us unloading fish.
And they want to know, what's going on here? They'll come in the shop, and Dustin or Justin Bunch, who works with him, will regale them with tall tales.
You know, we'll tell them, like, oh, we were these rigs, like, however far out, and, you know, we caught these tuna here, and then talk about the swordfish, like, this past trip, like, we ended up losing one, you know, or just tell them about, you know, if something interesting happened, or if we saw, like a couple trips back, we saw a whale, you know, and so we had some cool videos of that, and we were able to share that and talk about that. So just, I think they like hearing about just the experience, like what we see, because, I mean, we see all kinds of different stuff out there.
They become regulars, hanging around the shop, listening to fish stories.
Hey, if you can go to Publix and ask that guy to tell you who caught the fish, where they caught it, give you a fishing story, all in one, then, you know, go for it. But I don't think that's going to happen.
Back at Red or White in Fairhope, Chef David Ramey brings out the swordfish he cooked up. Tell me what's going on here.
We made a green garlic butter, which we roasted the swordfish in.
The fish is over a tomato ragu and polenta, a summer squash, and an olive tapenade. The fish is meaty, but it's still really tender and delicate. It tastes really clean. Just like Dustin was describing. It's clean. I don't know how else to describe it. David leaves me to my swordfish. I pull up a video of the Fairhope Fish House guys out on the boat, reeling in a swordfish. Looking at the date, it's probably the very fish I'm eating. The Gulf is calm in the video, the fish is big, unbelievably beautiful, and powerful. They pull it out and lay it out on a beanbag. I don't know how many swordfish they've caught, many to be sure, but they still stand around it, admiring it, like they can't wait to tell someone about their lucky catch.
Irina Zhuroff reported and produced this episode. She works in both print and audio. Her interests include mining, food and agriculture, environmental and land stories. She speaks Spanish and Russian and is a regular contributor to Gravy. In 2023, Scribner published her debut novel, Lost Believers. We thank Wendell Patrick for Gravy's theme music. We also owe a huge thank you to Clay Jones and Broadcast Studios in Oxford, Mississippi for recording and mixing Gravy. Managing editor for Gravy and all other SFA media is Sarah Camp Milam. Olivia Terenzio is our podcast editor. Fact-checking comes courtesy of Heather Cole. Mary Beth Lassiter is our publisher. Excited to lap up another episode of Gravy? Tell a friend. Pass the gravy boat. There is plenty to go around.